This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Hi, I'm Alex. I work on the briefing room. You've probably been hearing quite a lot recently about Hinkley Point. I have two, and I started looking into it, and what I found out actually made me realise for the first time just how important Hinkley Point is. So we have made a programme about it. Here it is. Here's David Aronovich with The Briefing Room.
Good evening. It would be the most expensive project in British history. So should Theresa May decide to build the Hinkley C nuclear power station in Somerset or not? Step inside the briefing room with me and I'll try and discover the costs and the benefits of the Hinkley decision. Joining me in the briefing room are four energy experts who have been following the Hinkley saga right from the beginning. But before I talk to them, reporter Alex Burton is here in the briefing room to explain how we got to this point.
Yes, David, you can trace Hinkley right the way back to 2005, when the then Prime Minister Tony Blair ordered a big review of the UK's energy infrastructure. Now, there were a couple of things that they hoped this review would sort out for the government. First of all, it needed to find a way to bring down our carbon emissions. And second, it needed to start replacing our old, ageing fleet of nuclear power stations, which all have a shelf life. Now, at that time, nuclear power was sort of in the political wilderness. It was thought that it was too expensive for them to start building new nuclear power stations.
So what changed?
Well, in the course of this review, the government clearly had a change of heart, and by 2006, nuclear was back on the agenda with a vengeance. That's Tony Blair's words. Still, the government knew it had to find a way to get these power stations built without loading billions of pounds in debt onto the public balance sheet. So the plan, right from the beginning, was to get industry to finance the whole lot. So industry would pay to design and build and operate all these new nuclear plants.
There are companies that actually do that?
Well, apparently so. There are a few contenders. A few people were interested. The front runner at the moment is the French energy company EDF. In 2006, Vincent Deriva, who was and still is the chief executive of EDF, came onto Radio 4 to talk about his company's nuclear ambitions for the UK.
In this room, one out of four lights are coming from nuclear. So the country is facing, in reality, in the next 10 years, a power crunch risk. We need to keep the lights on. We need to keep the prices affordable. And we need to tackle the climate change. I don't know if you have seen the very impressive film from Al Gore, The Inconvenient Truth. If we do not act now, the climate change will be having a big impact on us.
That was 2006, and then the following year, 2007, EDF said it expected to have a new power station built in time to power the cooking of our Christmas turkeys in 2017. Now, clearly that's not going to happen. There's been delay after delay over Hinkley Point and several long-running rows about how the project will be funded.
But I presume the government's kept to its promise of no public funding.
Well, I'm afraid that has unravelled. That started to unravel in 2011. EDF said in 2011 they could still deliver Hinkley by 2017, but it needed the government to sweeten the deal. And the government did sweeten the deal. Hergen Hay was the head of New Nuclear at the Department for Energy and Climate Change at the time.
We're talking very large projects with huge upfront capital costs. We had to do something to give certainty to the investors that these large sums of money are indeed safe and that no future government could just pull the plug. If you want to move to a low carbon future, you have to get involved as government because the market itself would never do it. And that is why In the UK, we adopted the Contract for Difference, which guarantees the price of electricity for a number of years, for renewables for 15 years, for nuclear for 35 years, and so on.
So the deal now is that EDF will get a guaranteed price for its nuclear energy, and any extra cost that that generates will go onto consumers' bills. So not taxpayer, but consumer bills.
But that was settled, what, 5 years ago, and there's still no plant and just delays.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. In 2013, one of the major investors in Hinkley, Centrica, which is the parent company of British Gas, quit the project, citing spiralling costs and delays. But another potential investor was on the horizon.
It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 19th of October. The news headlines this morning. The president of China arrives in this country this evening at the start of a four-day state visit.
Chinese investment in British nuclear power means British taxpayers' money can be used instead of building these things for building schools and hospitals. And in the long term, British families get lower and more stable energy bills.
So after all that, with Chinese investment in the bag and an agreement that EDF would receive a guaranteed price for the energy it generates at Hinkley, last week EDF agreed to the Hinkley plans, although I should say not without consequence for them. The company's finance director resigned in protest in March.
Yeah, but despite him, it was all systems go.
Yeah, I think the civil servants might have even booked Theresa May's train down to Somerset. But at the 11th hour, and to the surprise of many, it all came to a screeching halt all over again. The new Prime Minister said she wanted to take another look at the deal.
When's she going to come back with a decision?
Well, she's given herself 2 months to do it, so she's got a lot of thinking to do in that time.
Right, so let's try and help her with her thinking. Joining me in the briefing room are Peter Atherton, an energy analyst with Cornwall Energy. He was once head of corporate strategy for the National Grid before spending over 20 years at various investment banks. Lisa Waters is an economist with Waters Y Associates, which is an energy consultancy. Stephen Thomas is Professor of Energy Studies at Greenwich University and has just written a paper charting the history of Hinkley. And Malcolm Grimston is an energy and nuclear policy researcher and analyst and a visiting senior research fellow at Imperial College London's Centre for Energy Policy and Technology. And let's just kind of strip this down to first principles. Do we need Hinkley or something like it at all? Lisa Waters.
Yes, we're going to have to build something. So the old nuclear fleet are going to run down. And at some point, EDF will have to decide to shut them. And we've also got a lot of coal plant that must shut as it won't be able to meet environmental targets. And it's also just old equipment. What the government needs to do is it needs to achieve three things. Secure supplies, i.e. replace the missing power stations. It needs to do that in a way that is low carbon because it set itself very tight carbon budgets, and it needs to do that at a price that customers can afford to pay. It doesn't want to increase fuel poverty. So it's got to meet that trilemma of policy goals, and that's not easy.
Is this to do with, is this no matter what we do? Is this because we're going to be using that much power for sure, or because the power has to be created in a particular way or fashion?
Well, we don't exactly know how much power we will be using, and the forecasts from National Grid and the forecasts in the government differ. But basically, everyone still will expect to turn on their lights and then work. And we might use a lot more power if we have a lot of, for example, electricity heating or a lot of electric vehicles hitting the roads in the late 2020s, early 30s.
Peter Atherton.
Well, I agree with Lisa. The question is, what do you build? The reason the government back in 2006, 2007 decided that we needed a new nuclear programme was that, yes, they were worried about security of supplies. They looked 20 years ahead. But mainly they were trying to hit their environmental targets that they had signed up to a few years previously. It's very, very hard to reduce the amount of CO2 either in the economy, but specifically from the power sector, to the level that's being required if you don't have a sizable nuclear program.
One of those phrases you keep on hearing is the lights will go off if we don't build Hinkley. Is that true?
No, Hinkley won't be on stream, best case scenario, for at least 10 years. So there's plenty of time to do other stuff. But obviously, if you didn't build Hinkley and did absolutely nothing else and shut the plant down that we know is likely to shut in those 10 years, then the lights would most certainly be out and we'd all be sitting in the dark. But there's plenty of time to do other stuff if we need to.
Let's look, therefore, at the proposition here, Stephen Thomas. The technology behind Hinkley Point, why have we chosen this particular form of energy?
Well, we didn't choose this particular reactor. The government's idea in 2005, 2006 was that we would leave it to the market to choose. EDF, being largely owned by the French government, chose a design offered by Areva, a French company largely owned by the French government. EPR, the European Pressurised Water Reactor, which is what is proposed for Hinkley, is one of a new breed of nuclear power plants that was said to be safer, but it would be simpler and therefore easier to build and less likely for a cost to overrun in construction. And that was the big selling point of this new generation of plants of which EPR is one.
But presumably we took a look at the technology and said to ourselves, yes, this is one that we can go along with. I mean, we didn't just simply say, well, go and build whatever you like, we don't care. So presumably there's something about this technology which in a sense we kind of gave the green light to. What was it?
Well, we gave the green light to it in terms of safety. There was a four-year review by our nuclear safety regulator, which went through in exhaustive detail the design to ensure that it was safe enough to deploy in Britain.
But presumably, Malcolm Grimson, we care very much about whether what we thought it was a safe and relatively clean design.
Yes, that's right. Now, I mean, we've learned a lot about nuclear safety, I think, even since Fukushima. And the main message that I think people have picked up from Fukushima is that even with 1970s technology undergoing the sort of conditions which are perhaps unlikely in the United Kingdom of an earthquake and tsunami of that size, there still seems no likelihood that anybody is going to die as a result of radiation from that accident. And I think the debate has moved along a bit from safety. I think the polling in the UK suggests that support for nuclear returned to its pre-Fukushima levels within about 6 months of the accident. The difficulty is that we have spent so long on safety and made these plants so expensive that it's now being hit from the opposite direction, if you like, from the right of politics rather than the left, if I can put it that way, if you have anything that looks like a market in electricity, you're always battling the fact that you can build a combined cycle gas turbine quickly, cheaply, get your money back very quickly. So its economic risk is always going to be much lower.
Given all that, and given all the difficulties involved, and given all the caveats and requirements that we have, is the deal that we struck with EDF actually any good?
Well, I was, for a long time, wasn't at all sure. There's obviously one set of values which are too high to be politically sustainable or attractive to the consumer, and another set which are too low to bring the investment in the first place. I was very sceptical as to whether there was any overlap between those two sets at all. If there is, there's not much wriggle room. Even in the it's taken nearly 3 years since the strike price was fixed for the French and the Chinese to decide that they think this is a financially
viable... Just explain viable strike price to us.
Yes, it's in effect the guaranteed price for the first 35 years of the project, so two-thirds of the lifetime of the project in effect, which means that the massive risk for nuclear is that even if you build it an effective program, you then find that the electricity price is not enough to sustain it. Now, if you're building a gas turbine, the gas price goes up, which is your key thing, you can just pass that on to the consumer. They can't go anywhere else. In nuclear, it's managing the original program, and you can't do anything with those sunk costs if the power price is too low. So you need a kind of guarantee of long-term prices to manage that risk.
Steve Thomas, do you think that the EDF deal was, if you look at it realistically, the best deal we could have got?
That's very hard to say because there are so few nuclear power plants being built at the moment that it's very hard to know whether we're paying too much for this plant. The previous order for a plant of this design was placed in about 2008, and that was in China, so we don't know what the cost of that was. And there was one in Finland, and Finland had a fixed price deal for €3 billion, £2.5 billion. We're paying £9 billion, so there is clearly some discrepancy there.
Which seems like a way of saying no. Just a kind of a quick push on something related to this, Stephen Thomas. One of the big issues that's come up with the EDF and China deal is the fact that the Chinese are involved. And in fact, this week, a private eye has a rather kind of droll cover suggesting that the Chinese can turn our lights off because of their involvement with any kind of nuclear deal. Is this a red herring?
It's very difficult to know exactly what the concerns are, and different people have different emphases on it. It seems clear that the Ministry of Defence doesn't particularly like the involvement of the Chinese. I mean, some people are talking about this secret switch that would turn off the plant without anything we could do about it. Others are concerned about the Chinese getting access to some of our military technologies. And others are just don't like the idea of being involved with the Chinese because their record on proliferation technologies is not terribly good.
But can I just ask you this very quickly? Is there anything about the Chinese putting up funding for a deal like this that actually involves them in the technology of it?
Well, I think the reality is that they won't be involved much in the building of it, but I think they will be heavily involved in the supply chain. I mean, the French supplier has supplied very few plants over the last 20 years, whereas China is building, I don't know, 5 or 6 plants a year. So major components are likely to have to be sourced from China.
OK, so Prime Minister looking at what kind of deal the EDF deal is. And one of the things that she's got to consider is what the alternatives could conceivably be. Given what you said, Lisa Waters, right at the beginning about the need to fill a gap and to do it in a particular way, let's look at what the realistic alternatives to a Hinkley decision would be if we didn't take it.
Well, so the big issue is the fact that the government set itself these carbon targets to reduce emissions of carbon dioxide by 80% on 1990 levels by 2050. So what it really needs is very low carbon or no carbon generation. So its options are wind at the moment, solar, which it seems to have managed to subsidise to the degree that the price of delivering those technologies is now falling substantially. It could use batteries. That's the new technology that everyone wants on the system in order to store the wind when it's windy and we don't want the electricity it's generating and use it when we do.
That's always been the big objection to wind, hasn't it, really?
Yes.
Which is it's kind of, what do you call that? Intermittency, yeah.
But there are some renewable technologies that aren't intermittent. So, for example, it could use biomass. You can convert old coal stations into biomass. You could certainly work hard on energy efficiency to try and reduce some demand.
Could you explain biomass to me very briefly?
Biomass is where you burn fuel as you would in a conventional power station, but the fuel itself is a sustainable fuel, for example, wood.
These are essentially are renewables. Now, the objection, Peter Atherton, what's the normal objection to relying so much or to trying to fill this gap with renewables or mostly with renewables?
So it would be even more expensive than Hinkley, although it's hard to imagine if it were expensive than Hinkley. But if you try to do it through, certainly the renewables we have available today would be more expensive. So the government's advised on this by several organisations, one being the Committee on Climate Change, which was set up as a sort of advisory body under the Climate Change Act, and also people like National Grid. And if you look at all the documents that those organisations produce saying how you're going to hit the targets that Lisa was talking about, every single one of them or their central scenarios always has a large nuclear element in it, because even at the cost of Hinkley, that would be cheaper than doing it via, say, offshore, a very heavily offshore wind system. Essentially, the thing about nuclear power is it runs 24/7. It produces an awful lot of power. So to replace 1 gigawatt worth of nuclear with an equivalent amount of offshore wind, for example, you probably need something like 4 to 5 gigawatts of offshore wind, which would be very, very expensive indeed.
Stephen Thomas.
I think the big problem that we have in Britain is the cost of energy, which in the past 10 years, the cost of electricity has just about doubled in real terms. So we have a real problem of fuel poverty. So the last thing we need to do is to start building things that are going to put the price of electricity up. Hinkley by itself will have quite a small effect, but this Hinkley is the first of a programme of perhaps 5 times the size of Hinkley. So that would have a significant impact on the cost of electricity. But if we look at energy efficiency, that would be probably just as cost effective, perhaps more so, but it would be bringing down people's energy costs to a much more affordable level. So it would have the dual advantage of reducing our carbon emissions, but getting some way to solving the problem of fuel poverty, which is a real issue for many families in Britain who can't afford their energy bills.
Malcolm Grimston, some of the things that have been said there, and let's face it, there are some kind of disagreements within that mix. One possibility is that actually you don't need to generate as much new electricity as you thought you did because you could become significantly more efficient. Another one is that you could make much greater use of renewables, even despite the problem with intermittency, because we're going to get battery technology. And one thing I keep on hearing about is that you just extend the life of existing power stations. Between them, do they construct an alternative to something like Hinkley?
It doesn't look so if you do all the numbers. And first thing to say is we're not sitting here saying we should do just one thing and get the whole solution. Everything we've mentioned today has to be judged against the background that we've closed about a quarter of our reliable generating capacity in the last 5 years, and about half of what's left is going to go in the next 15 years, which is just around the corner when we look at energy. I mean, I'm a little sceptical. The energy efficiency is not the same as reducing energy. It's rather like saying that if we had not built the super energy efficient jumbo jet and we were still flying around in turboprops or gypsy moths, we'd be using vastly more energy on flying because we'd be doing 15 billion passenger miles in gypsy moths. No, actually, it's only because energy efficiency came along that we do use a vast amount of energy on aviation, because it's become cheap enough to do so. And these rebound effects can vary anywhere from between 10 and 15% to over 100%. There are some areas where quite clearly you do that. It's the same argument about labour productivity. We don't want to improve productivity to increase unemployment. We want to increase employment.
So to take Lisa Walter's point about electric cars, what you're saying in effect is if we become more energy efficient, we'll use up that energy efficiency on more electric cars.
Some of it.
Or something like
that. There'll be some benefit, but certainly a 10% increase in energy efficiency does not reduce energy use by 10%.
Lisa Walters, I'm struck by something, which is the way in which the building of something like a nuclear power station becomes part, if you like, almost of a kind of national psyche question. Do you think there's a kind of, I don't know, some strange psychological desire for big plant?
I do think there is a bit of a psychological desire, not just for big plant, but for big, new, shiny technologies. This is first of a kind, and first of a kind generally is expensive. But, you know, you might well want to be the minister standing there cutting the tape and having a picture on the paper, because I have delivered infrastructure. I've done this.
Stephen Thomas, you look at the history of this. Do you think that there is that prestige element somewhere sitting in the back there?
I'm sure there is. As you say, it's much more photogenic to be cutting the ribbon at a nuclear power station than a cavity wall insulation job. So I'm sure that the idea, and perhaps Tony Blair's psyche, was let's solve this energy problem, nuclear program, job done, whereas an energy efficiency program or small-scale renewables needs ongoing management, which is not what any politician wants to do.
OK, let's look at what the costs are if Theresa May says no to Hinkley, presumably financial, commercial and others. Peter Atherton, what do you think the costs are?
Well, we know what the cost of Hinkley would be, which is £92.50 per megawatt hour. That means that in reality, when by the time, because that's actually in 2012 money, so by the time it commissions in around 2025, 2026, that's likely to be something like £120 per megawatt hour. Now, the current wholesale price is about 40, and the highest sustainable price we've ever had in our history is about 70. £120 megawatt hour is the equivalent of having oil around about $225 to $250 per barrel. So that's very, very expensive electricity against any scenario one can realistically think at the moment where fossil fuel prices are likely to be. To replace Hinkley in terms of pure capacity, so we weren't worried about the environmental targets, we could just do it through gas.
I didn't mean so much just in the replacement. I just meant in a decision to, if it were made in 2 months, just not to do it. What have we invested? What will we lose?
So EDF have said that they've invested £2.4 billion. The government have said in parliamentary answers that we have not guaranteed any of that £2.4 billion. However, there would be a very substantial knock-on effect to the rest of the new nuclear programme. So there are five other projects in development, as well as Hinkley. The question is, would any of those projects be able to go forward if the government, at the very, very last second, for policy reasons, so not for safety reasons, that would be different, but for policy reasons, decided to pull the plug on Hinkley? And I think the question is, would we have to reboot the entire programme? either both a, go to a completely different way of trying to achieve nuclear, or actually go to a different way of trying to achieve the various trilemma targets that you talked about before?
Well, presumably your argument is that we would. Malcolm Grimston.
Well, I think it potentially goes even wider than that. Obviously, in the post-Brexit world, our relationship with inward investment from other parts of the world is going to become more important. And I just wonder what sort of signal it sends out, that if we can encourage, very positively encourage EDF to spend this $2.5 billion on the site over the course of several years, to very positively encourage the Chinese to get involved in it, put a huge amount of resource into assessing the project, coming up with the financing deal and so on. And we then say, after you've done all that in good faith, we may well then pull the plug on you, either at this stage or potentially at a later stage in the project. And I wonder what Britain will look like as a reliable and responsible partner for inward investment.
Okay. Well, why don't you answer that question? What do you think it would
be? I think it would be horrendous. Peter says it would be particularly important, given that we are going to rely on Japanese money or French money through Gaz de France, Energies is now all through EDF, if we want new nuclear, unless it's the taxpayer that's going to have to build it. And at the moment, the prospects of that look very, very weak.
Peter Atherton.
Yeah, it can't be done in isolation. So if you were to say no to Hinkley, then you have to have it as a part of a bigger policy decision to either reboot the new nuclear program and go to a completely different type of program, or you have to actually revisit the environmental targets and actually perhaps delay them and push them back.
Which is a lot to do in 2 months to come to a view on something that's taken 20 years to come to.
Well, also, and presumably very controversial. Stephen Thomas.
I think the new government has one great advantage, which is that it is a new government with clean hands, so it can legitimately say, look, we're coming in here with a fresh view on it. I think the fact that money has been spent does not justify wasting more money. And of course, all the people involved will scream if we do pull the plug on the nuclear programme, and they will tend to talk up the amount of money they've invested because they have every incentive to do that. But I think Theresa May has to bite the bullet and say, you know, this is a programme that is going wrong, it's out of control, and it's going to cost taxpayers and electricity consumers a lot of money, so we need to stop it.
OK, Stephen Thomas, that's your clear answer. So let's get the answer of the other commentators on whether they think she should go ahead or not. Lisa Waters, straightforward, yes or no?
No. I think the price of it has just escalated beyond control already. It started in 2007 being $7 billion. We're in 2015 and it's up at $18 billion. That is an amazing trajectory. And there are other technologies out there. And I wouldn't say no to nuclear, but I think you have to go back and say not at this price.
Malcolm Grimston.
I think so. I mean, if we wait for a perfect world, we're going to be waiting until the power really does go out. It is very low carbon. It's reliable in the sense that we don't need imported gas for it and we don't need the wind to be blowing. It is highly expensive, but the key thing is it is spade ready. You know, the idea that we're going to spend another 8 years coming up with the next solution and then packing off with that, while all the evidence around the world is that when you pull out of nuclear, you move back into fossil fuels. Germany's showing that. Japan's showing us that.
Peter Atherton, it's 2-1 against. Where are you going to go?
Well, look, I've argued for many years that this is a very poor deal for the UK consumer, and nothing's changed in my mind. But clearly there are real risks, some of the geopolitical risks that we've talked about and what you do with energy policy. I would doubt that they outweigh the absolute cost of Hinkley, but actually a lot of those risks are political, so it really is one for the politicians to weigh.
Now, come on, yes or no?
I would pull it personally, but I'm not
okay.
a good person to look at those political risks.
So if the Prime Minister's listening, that's 3-1. My thanks to Peter Atherton, Lisa Waters, Stephen Thomas and Malcolm Grimston. And over to you, Mrs. May. We'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to The Briefing Room with David Aronovich. It was produced by Michael Wendling and Alex Burton with Kirsty Knight and Joe Kent. You can email us at thebriefingroom@bbc.co.uk. And why not try another BBC podcast? Search for Can We Learn to Live with Nuclear Power? And you'll find an edition of Radio 4's Analysis in which Michael Blaslin charts changing public opinion towards nuclear.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.